Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the annual access lecture at University College. It's the eighth lecture in our series. Each of them has looked at a dimension of access. We've had lectures in the past on the history of higher education and social mobility, on the contribution that MOOCs might make to access, on the contribution that independent schools might make to social mobility, and much else besides. Our speaker this evening is Danny Dorling, who is a professorial fellow at St. Peter's and holds the Holford Mackinder Chair of Geography, and has had spells before that at Sheffield, Newcastle, Bristol, Leeds, and New Zealand. What does a geographer have to say about access? Well, we're about to find out. Danny Dorling is a social geographer. He has a special interest in the geographical structure of social inequality in all its various dimensions: income, wealth, housing, health, employment, and of course, education. He is a prolific publisher, and these include accessible pieces for non-geographers in the national press and among other outlets at the Times Higher, and I noticed only yesterday in the Independent. And he's also the founder of the World Mapper website, which I strongly recommend. It hosts almost 700 maps where territories are resized on each map according to the subject of interest. So if you look up the map on, for example, the number of women in a country that have tertiary education, the world map looks very, very different from the maps that we are accustomed to. The United States is huge and Africa is tiny. But there are lots of other fascinating maps. You can while away quite a long time looking at it. Well, this evening, Danny is going to turn his telescope around and speak not about the world, not even, as I understand it, the UK, but Oxford. And Oxford is not the centre of the world. This is not a reflection of our well-known institutional self-absorption. He has personal grounds as well. He was born here. He went to a local state school, or schools here, including Cheyne School, before he went on to Newcastle University. In the article that I mentioned just before, in the Independent that was published yesterday, the last paragraph starts, "We live in a world in which those who've got to the top have got there, not out of great merit, but because they often had a few unfair advantages to start with." And I suspect that this theme will be touched upon in the talk that is about to come. But whether the unfair advantage consists of the opportunity to get to Oxford, or whether the unfair advantage consists of being of having arrived at Oxford, I'm not quite sure. Over to Dan.
Thank you, Ivor. Thank you very much for the invitation to give this lecture. I'm only going to speak for just over 30 minutes to you, and we're then going to do questions and answers, and I'm most interested in what questions you have and what you want to ask me about my opinions. I'm not going to give you a formula for how I think we ought to decide who comes to Oxford. I'm going to give you my considered opinion, having been here this part of Oxford, the university part of Oxford, rather than the other side of Oxford, for about 4 years. I've never worked in any university that has been more obsessed by which students it gets than this university. More reports, more analysis, more worries than every other university I've worked in combined. That is probably because I've worked in other universities which have often simply worried about getting students. And particularly since the cap came off and we have an open market in students, right across the country, the normal worry is, will they carry on coming? But the obsession here goes beyond that. And I think, although I can't prove, that it's greater than it has been for several decades. I think the worry about who comes to Oxford, and also the innovation that there is around the university about trying to change that, is similar to the worry there was last in the 1930s. There was a wonderful book called Political Arithmetic, published in 1938, I think edited by Lancelot Hogby, in which he made the claim that more imbeciles from the top public schools got into Oxford than geniuses from the working class. And this was very unfair. They weren't imbeciles. It's just that back in those days, you weren't made to do very well at exams from top public schools. It was simply arranged. There were places that were only available to you. But in the 1930s, there was an obsession about who came to Oxford and Cambridge. And there were Acts of Parliament to alter things. Why such an obsession then? Why such an obsession now? Well, the country was incredibly unequal then, and the country is incredibly unequal now. And one way of thinking about reducing the unfairness of those inequalities is to say, if only we could have a more fair entry system to who comes here, then who goes on to become High Court judges and MPs and Prime Ministers would be a lot fairer than it currently is. Now, there is an alternative way of thinking about this, which is to say it would be better if more of our High Court judges and our MPs and our Prime Ministers had actually come from a wider range of backgrounds, and they don't have to come through this particular university. But we find that quite hard to accept. I think you might want to say I'm wrong about this. That's my preferred view. I really don't think we should have an obsession about channeling through this place people we think we can identify at 16 or 17 who can go on to rule the world. And I think that's part of our problem. This gives you a clue of what's coming next in case you're already getting bored. I'm going to talk one slide about narcissism, a couple of slides about potential prejudice, 12 slides, I'm afraid, about maps. There's going to be a lot of geography in this. I feel more confident about geography than anything else. And then 7 slides at the end, suggestions, and I'm going to have a little go at GCSEs. Right, you have to have good eyesight to see this. This is still what you see on the university website if you click on the front page for admissions. Now, I'm being a bit unfair here because these are the words you see. What I'm not showing you is the photograph. The photograph shows 3 students, none of whom are white, 2 are female, and 1 is wearing the veil. Right, that's the photograph. The photograph is very progressive, not very representative of Oxford, but different. But the text is old-fashioned. The text is, Oxford University is world famous for academic excellence. But if we're that famous, why do we have to shout about it? We pick the best and brightest students purely on their academic merit and passion for their chosen courses. The best and brightest, as if you can take young people, and we do take more young people than most universities. Other universities tend to take a few people a bit older, but we don't. So if you can take all young people and put some into a set called the best and another into a set called the brightest, and then intersect those 2 sets, and somehow we're very good at spotting the best and the brightest, whatever best and brightest actually means. If that sounds like you, and you like to think for yourself, Oxford could be the right university for you. This is my worry about the narcissism net, and I have a worry that this institution has a problem that other institutions don't have. It is not our fault. An institution in the UK was going to have this problem. There are all kinds of ranking systems, from winning boat races to scoring highly in the ref, and this university is number 1. Cambridge is number 2. It's not because we're better, the reason is geographical. When this college began, when the colleges in Cambridge began, pretty even. Then somebody sailed across the Atlantic. When they sailed across the Atlantic, that meant that cities on the west coast of England, Liverpool, Manchester, Glasgow, could grow, and Oxford suddenly finds itself in the middle of the country. Cambridge, I'm afraid, is a bit off. That geographical reason, for me, is the reason why Oxford ends up being so much of the centre, so many prime ministers, why houses cost £100,000 here more than Cambridge, but it creates a problem. Not just for our undergraduates, but also for our staff. Because you don't necessarily want to attract people who think they are the brightest and the best all the time. It could be a dangerous thing to do. And why are we saying to applicants coming here, if you can think for yourself? Are we trying to tell them that we think that people who choose to go to other universities can't think for themselves? Are we worried that in fact their school or their parents is doing the thinking for them, and we want to try to convince them, no, it's your idea to come to Oxford, it isn't actually what your parents spent all that money on, or what your school desperately, desperately wants, because it'll make it look really good in the rankings. It's you. It's our fault we've got this problem, but we have this particular problem, and it is a danger. And it doesn't just apply to our students, it applies to all of us. Potential for prejudice. This is the famous sentences from the agreed common criteria. To attract applicants from the most academically able individuals, irrespective of socioeconomic, ethnic or national origin. So colourblind. We're not going to concern ourselves with these other things that we know have a huge effect on what your grades actually are. To ensure applicants are selected for admission on the basis that they are well qualified and have the most potential to excel in their chosen course of study. And by well qualified, we mean the standard examinations. We don't question very much about whether doing very well at those standard examinations, GCSEs and A-levels in the main, is what could qualify you to do very well at a degree, to be imaginative, to do something different, to think outside the box. One of my many prejudices, and you're already beginning to learn I've got many, is that I honestly think that as examinations have become harder in this country, and they have, because our teachers have become better. I was taught by men demobbed from the war in Cheney in the 1980s. Not all, but a significant number of men, many with fingers missing, interestingly, if I remember. The teaching staff of this country have got better and better and better. The quality of what happens in our schools on average has got better. That's just made it harder. Examinations are more and more about jumping through hoops. You arrive at a university having learned how to jump through hoops, having learned how to follow a particular syllabus, and then you suddenly find that there are no national examinations here. They're made up every year by a small group of people, and you really can't work out exactly what you need to do to get the top marks. It's a very, very different place. The potential to excel in their chosen study. The word potential is one that has risen and risen and risen in education in the last four decades. People should be able to achieve their potential. We're looking for that potential. If they've got that potential, we're going to pull that potential out of them. This is my latest attempt to go back and find where this word came from in education. And it's an ironic place. It's actually in the Rights of the Child, in the UN Rights of the Child, but decades after this. This is Aldous Huxley, who gave a lecture in Berkeley in 1960, in which Aldous, who hated eugenics, that's why he wrote Brave New World about the alpha, beta, gamma children, and partly because he had a squint, and partly because he didn't like other members of his family who were into it. But Aldous, who disliked eugenics, said in Berkeley in 1960, the neurologists have shown us that no human being has ever made use of as much as a 10% of all the neurons in his brain. And perhaps if you set about it the right way, we might be able to produce extraordinary things out of this strange piece of work that man is. Since 1960, we haven't supercharged any human being to be able to use 10 times as many neurons from their brain. This idea that there is this great untapped potential that can be wired up and geared up, or that there is a different level of potential in different people, and particularly different children, and some have greater potential than others, and if you can identify them and pull them in, then you can make the best use of your resources, because they have more space that's vacant just waiting to be used, and others have limited space. There really is no evidence for this, but it has become a hegemonic idea in education. You see it again and again to fulfill the potential. If you teach in a school, in a state school, every child that you teach will now have a number. Often the number is provided by the Fisher Family Trust, and it's an estimate of the children's potential and what they should be achieving. It is Brave New World. We now have Brave New World in our way of thinking. So I'm talking against what is the accepted quiet wisdom in education. It is kept quiet because it is such a nasty idea in some ways. But the idea that we are vessels with different potential, that potential is fixed fairly early on, and you have to identify the ones who can go up. Some maps. We are talking about a remarkably small number of people. If you are analysing university admissions from a normal university, you're talking about many, many more times than this. So the first thing that hits you is how few people you're talking about. This is a normal map of the students admitted in 2009. Don't worry, it's varied a little bit, so we're not giving away any individual person. In fact, Northern Ireland, we couldn't even map it at all there. Now, a normal map just looks like the map of the population of the country. Doesn't tell you very much. There's London, lots from London, a few from Birmingham, a few from Manchester. And we were still getting some from Scotland back in 2009. We're not getting so many from Scotland now. This map over here is what's called a population cartogram. And so we stretch the map so that every person has the same amount of space. Now, if there was no bias in potential, ability, R selection, whatever else, you would expect an even distribution of little dots here. As it is, this is Birmingham, and we don't get that many students from Birmingham, particularly the middle of Birmingham. This is where we are. I realise almost all of you have never seen these maps before, and it's strange. But just remember, you've almost certainly been picked to work here because of your enormous potential and ability. So it shouldn't take you long. And of course, because you're at Oxford, you cannot admit that you haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. Right? You can, honestly, if I gave you that. And then from London, we don't take many from this part. It's east side of London. For some reason, we take a large number from this sway through the middle. There's a bit of a gap there. The cluster over there. Anybody want to guess where that cluster is? It's Cambridge, yes. I can understand why you want to get away from home. That's why I went to Newcastle. It's the furthest place you can go in England from Oxford. My main reason to go. Well, who wants to be in this little market town any longer? I'll talk about myself a little bit more. But there's the distribution of our students. And of course it's reflecting all kinds of things. It's reflecting social, economic distributions and other things. But that is a very uneven map. And that's the distribution 3 years later in 2012. And it's very similar. There are several changes. I'll just show you one. That's the East End in 2009. That's the East End in 2012. Look, we're doing better. There. 2009, 2012. I don't want to appear to be too cynical. Because there's a huge amount of effort and work that is done. And if that effort and work was not done, the East End would be empty. We would have far fewer from the East End. And I know some of you will be doing that work. The question is, why have we gone from not many in the East End to a cluster? Part of it will be the work of particular individuals, particular schools. Part of it is gentrification of the East End of London. Right? You cannot afford to live in the East End of London now if their schools are doing better. Let's click forward. We spend, and donors to this university spend enormous amounts of money on this, on admissions. One way in which money is spent are bursaries, the most generous bursaries in the country, I think. And these little dots are showing the bursaries in 2009 and 2012. There was a bit less money in 2012. The red dots are the pupils receiving £5,000 a year towards their fees. Really high bursaries. I've got to zoom in because you can't see very much there. Let's zoom in around Oxford. The black dots are students receiving no bursaries. These are students in roughly the top fifth of the income distribution. We're all learning income distributions at the moment, thanks to the election, when you suddenly discover that only 5% of people are paid £80,000 or more. How can they possibly get by? Anyway, that's most of our black dots, is most of the students. The red dots are the ones who come from the poorest families. And one reason I draw maps like this, rather than work out statistics, is because the numbers are so small, but also you can see things that you can't see in the statistics. If you look at the red dots, you'll see that there aren't any red dots here. Whatever the bursary scheme did, it did not drag large numbers of students in, or even small numbers of students in, from areas in which we were not getting many students before. The red dots are mostly sitting quite near to a black dot. Now, the red dot is a student whose family income is low, very low. Black dot students whose family income is very high. How can they be very near to each other geographically? And the answer is often, I suspect, because mum and dad are split up. It's a stereotype, but if you have a scheme that gives you a bursary if you're on a low family income, the fastest and easiest way to get a low family income is divorce. It is not necessarily targeting students from the areas in which we don't get many students. And that's the kind of thing that's hard to see if you don't look at this. In Oxford, it's North Oxford. But it will be somebody on very low income in North Oxford. But they probably weren't on low income 3 years earlier. Doesn't mean it's still not a struggle to be here and the expenses of being here, but it means it isn't working. Okay, I'm going to open up about my personal bias. We've all got personal biases. This is mine. The most famous person who came from Murfield in Yorkshire, West Riding, was Jean-Luc Picard, otherwise known as Patrick Stewart, the actor. Patrick Stewart didn't go, as far as I know, to university. Patrick Stewart, if he had, would have been a little red dot. There is only one little red dot somewhere near Murfield. The second most famous person from Murfield, as far as I'm concerned in Yorkshire, is my grandfather. And my grandfather, who won't be known to you, is famous from Murfield because he won a place in Oxford in 1935. And grew up in a very small terraced house, and all his sisters at the age of 14 went to work in the mill. Now, why am I bothered about this? As far as I can see, the general geographical pattern of our acceptances is just as biased now as it was back in 1935. The chances of a boy, or at least now a girl, from Murfield getting into Oxford is no greater than it was when my granddad got in. That's how static the picture is. There may have been a period in between where it improved more, but it didn't improve much. There he is, with a little moustache in 1938. Those moustaches were very fashionable, apparently. By 1939, they'd all been gone. there he is in 1949, looking all confident and so on. Because the defining moment of his life was Oxford. The most important thing that ever happened to him was coming to Oxford. Completely understandable, changed everything. The war ranked second in terms of what was most important. And it wasn't just my granddad who came. My mother followed him and came. Her lover came here. Both their brothers came here. I've got other uncles from here. I think at least one of my aunts went here, but I lose count of how many aunts I've got. I have cousins So I'm from a family in which it was normal, became normal, to come to Oxford. I didn't go, as I've said, to Oxford. There's no need for me to go. By the time you got to the third generation, the advantage of coming to Oxford just wasn't there. It was usually advantageous for my granddad to come here. But you get these families. I'm one of them, where it's seen as very important to come. And that clogs up the spaces. Whereas if you really want to transform lives, you want to take people... He was the first in his family to ever go to university, let alone this one. But he didn't know this one was strange, because nobody had gone to another one, so it was fine. Right, enough about that side of me. Let's look in a bit more detail about who we take and where we take from. Now, this is Oxford East and Oxford West. Oxford East is the red circled area, and it's a very strange map. I've zoomed in on it because I'm about to show you the whole map. Oxford East has more children than Oxford West and Abingdon. More children are born, more children go up, more children go to school. But less than half as many children get 3 A's at A level. We know this from UCAS applications. So I'm drawing Oxford East small, because if we're only interested in children who get 3 A's or more from A level, Oxford East for us is small. Oxford West and Abingdon is 2.3 times bigger. You see what I'm doing? So I'm saying let's accept the unfairness of society. Let's accept that for some reason children from Oxford East are much less likely to get 3 A's and have any chance of coming here than children from Oxford West. Are we still being fair with our admissions? Now, let's zoom out to the whole country. There's the whole country. Here's Oxford West, Abingdon, and Oxford East. That's the bit you've just been looking at. This is London and Greater Greater London. That's where we're looking. As soon as we say 3 A's, that's the bulk of it. And you might say, well, as long as we're fair within that criteria, as long as we're fair for the children to get 3 A's or above at A level, then we're doing the best we can, and it's not our fault that the schools aren't good enough, whatever we say. I personally don't think we have much of a leg to stand on all these arguments, because we produce more politicians with more power than any other university. So if there is a problem with the education system in Britain, it is more our fault, or at least the fault of our predecessors in this university, than any other university. But anyway, that's the playing field that we're working on, 3 A's and above. And these maps, the maps end soon, if you've had enough of maps. These maps show you the chance of applying to Oxford for those children who get 3 A's and above. I've put the normal map up for once because it's an interesting little line there. You just about see the line, the diagonal line of colour? If you're that side, you're less likely to apply. Our guess is you're more likely to apply for Cambridge, because it's a bit easier to get to. Unless, of course, you live in Cambridge, in which case you want to get away. But you go to that particular state school. And come over here. This map is much more informative because you're actually looking at where the children are. And the blue areas, 30 to 35% of all candidates who get 3 A's apply to Oxford. In the yellow areas and the orange areas, 5% down to 0%. So we are not getting applicants from much of the north, but they're qualified. We are getting a huge number of applicants from the centre of London. And it's not just because lots of people get 3 A's and above from the centre of London. There's a real expectation for those families to come. This is who actually gets in. Again, the normal map, the cartogram, and you're looking at differences. This is 12, 13% of that group, with 3 A's down to 1 or 0%. Really, really big differences. So it's not just who applies. Even after people apply, there is still a geographical bias in who actually gets in that cannot be explained just by qualifications. Now, some much easier maps, thanks to Peter at the back for these, which just look at the regions of England and say, first of all, on the basis of the number of children, that we're not getting 2,000 applicants from the north, and correcting for the actual A levels that children get, we're still not getting 1,000 applicants from the north with 3 A's and above. And we're getting 853 too many from London, if you're going to be even. That's the geographical extent of what we're dealing with. Despite all the effort, despite all the outreach, it's a huge bias geographically. The bias by schools is higher, but I'm not going to talk about that because I haven't looked at the data, I've just seen some of it. That's the geographical bias. Let's zoom through just about 4 minutes more, and then I will stop. There is a national problem. That quote from a recent report shows you a national problem. We get so much attention because we're at the top of it. We are not the worst offender. Right? The worst offenders are Durham and Exeter and so on. We put far more effort in, but we are part of this. And this is an enormous inequality, not just in who gets to university, but what kind of university they get to, and so on. I won't read the quote out for you. That's just the national context we're in. There is also a worry, and maybe this is less of a worry for our undergraduates, perhaps for our master's students, but in US universities, there's increasing evidence, this comes from a study from 2015, increasing evidence of university courses or university name being seen as a positional good. You want to bag the word Yale or Harvard on your CV if you're rich and can afford it. Right. And there's a danger of that applying to us as well. Along with Ralph Lauren clothing, designer boots and designer jewellery. Some suggestions. A huge amount is being done. I acknowledge a huge amount is being done. I think it would be very interesting if somebody were to paint a picture of what it would look like if we didn't do what we are doing. And in which case it would be far worse than the 1930s was my suspicion. I don't know why we consider it so normal for people to come here at 18. I really don't know why, if we take it so seriously who we get, why we worry that a year wasted in their life would be such a waste of the nation, unless too many of us believe the idea of these are golden children and the country so much depends on their brilliance that we're going to suck out of them, that waiting a year till after they've got their A-levels and you know what they've got would be a year too wasted. I don't know why we don't try to take more a bit later. And when they've had a little bit more time to think. I happen to think this is sensible for all young people because of student loans. Getting into this enormous debt on something that you're not completely sure you want to do, on a course you're not sure, I think it would make sense to wait a year for everybody, if you can. It's very hard to get work if you're that young. I haven't considered inequalities between schools. They are far worse. There are schools where 50% of the children come here. In a sense, they are factories which operate to get children here. And we need to know that. People have often said to me in the 4 years I've been here, we should do what Harvard does. We should have a needs-blind system. And what you need to know about what Harvard does is that the average Harvard parent is on an income of $450,000 a year, if Stefan Collini's figures are right. That's why the Harvard option doesn't work, because Tony works for one or two universities and you still end up with the average parent being on that amount of money. Back to the narcissism effect that I began with. And the problem of students not applying from the north. Now, most of the effort says, how can we get more to apply? But of course, we haven't got more places, so we'll be lining up more people not to get in. I'm not against it, but I'll just point out. But we can, or we could, in future, begin to think about having places for people who do not apply here. That gets past the problem of the not applying. It also gets past the problem of people applying because it's what their parents want or their school wants, or they like the name of Oxford, but actually they're not fascinated by wanting to do geography for some strange reason. I can't understand why. How could you begin to take people who haven't applied here? You use adjustment. Adjustment came in a couple of years ago. After you get your A-levels, You're allowed to think again about where you might want to come. If we had unfilled places, and I suspect we do have unfilled places, and we find out we have unfilled places straight after the A-levels because somebody goes to Yale or does something else or drops out, we could use adjustment to fill those unfilled places. People coming in on adjustment would have A-levels just as good as the people who come here, but they would have thought about it at the last minute. Other universities use it. It is small. You're talking a very small number of students, but I think it would be interesting to do, and then you'd look at who you got. At the moment, GCSEs are our main route to actually deciding who we're going to let in. So my last couple of slides are GCSEs. I did a talk recently to geography students about the new GCSEs. The new GCSEs are truly awful because they are so impossibly hard. Already, teachers are spending their entire time simply teaching national curriculum. They cannot take a lesson out to teach something more interesting. The new GCSEs have crammed it even more. So unless you can teach the children up to 10 because you've got them in your boarding school, you can't actually cover the curriculum. This is the question one on the specimen paper for AQA geography. The question is wrong on question number one. It will be ironed out, but so study figure one, a map showing the location of 10 of the world's top 10 megacities. Now it's not just wrong because of, 10 of the world's top 10. There aren't any in China.
No.
Right? There are none in China as far as they're concerned on this GCSE. Now it's wrong, but if as a child you write down where are the Chinese ones, you will not get any marks for that question. GCSEs were about jumping through particular hoops. You have to write on the new GCSE geography to get full marks that in Croydon, trams that run on train tracks in the road are being reintroduced. They're environmentally good because they run on electricity and do not release greenhouse gases. That is the correct answer to a question. Now this is some kind of special electricity that they have in South London generated. But again, a child who points that out will be in trouble. And you have to learn spelling, grammar, punctuation and so on is now much more important because Michael Gove decided it was. And you've also got to rote learn a huge number of phrases. It's 20 pages of these for geography, including that the Commonwealth is a voluntary association of 53 independent equal sovereign states which came together happily. It's in the new GCSE. We prize A stars and A's at GCSE incredibly highly. But to get all the A's and A stars, you have to learn exam technique, you have to be well disciplined, behaved. It's not necessarily the best route, the best thing to use. I haven't got enough time to go through these slides, but these slides from Peter show GCSEs basically still map deprivation and riches. Posh people, I spent 4 hours yesterday with my 15-year-old teaching him maths. Posh people like me give our children advantages. They have a pay a tutor or they can do it themselves. Poorer people cannot do the GCSEs and have no money for the tutors. It's not about the schools. When you take out the 500 weakest secondary schools in England, the graph looks almost exactly the same. Selecting by GCSE or selecting by parents' poshness. That is what we are currently doing because it's what we've got. We have tests and other things. They're not particularly brilliant. Our error is trying to find indicators from a 16-year-old about what they might do. You simply have to wait till after the A-levels. The A-levels are much better predictors of how they then do in their first year and final exams than the GCSEs. My last slide. The GCSEs that have come in, the new ones to being taken now, will tell us even less about children because they are just far too crammed. Internationally, our children, along with American children, are learning in a worse way than children in any other rich nation. We know this because when we test them at the age of 24, they cannot do things like maths as well as children in other countries. They do fine at maths at age 15 or 16 because they've learnt what they need to pass the GCSE because their dad spent 3 hours with them on a Sunday going through, this is how you do question 7. Question 7 is always the same. Right. That is not how to become good at maths. It is how to get an A at GCSE at maths. How would I rewrite the question or the thing on our admissions? If I was being silly about it, I wouldn't write brightest and the best. I would say, do you really like libraries? Do you really, really like libraries? Do you want to come somewhere where there's over 100 libraries, where you couldn't possibly go to more libraries than there is? Because that's what we've got. We've got libraries. Do you not like the idea of nightclubs? Because to be honest, our nightclubs are not very good. Do you want to spend your time in libraries, not nightclubs? Do you not like hills? Because they're a bit disappointing. Right? Do you not like sailing? Because it's a long way. Do you really want to come and study? And maybe at the end, would you like to have a much higher chance of getting on University Challenge than almost anybody else because we get more teams? I'm obviously a fantasist about what will change. This place changes slowly, but it changed slowly in the 1930s, 40s and 50s to get to a point by the 1960s when it had the most incredible mix of people. That's why my mum and dad actually ended up here. Because my mum wouldn't have got in the 1930s, but she could get in the 1960s from a state school. And my dad got in from a private school. And this place was a melting pot and a mixing place of people in the 60s. It is becoming less of that in the 80s, 90s, and now. It only changes when the policy of the place changes. The policy of the place changes in a reflection of national mood and national sentiment, and until that alters, we're going to find it very hard to change more. But Oxford is taking more state school children than it's taken for 40 years, although when you look at which state schools, it's not quite as exciting as that. There is obviously a wish to change things here. And my final point there is, if I was trying to maximise anything, it wouldn't be potential. I'd actually be trying to maximise the happiness of our students. And that's not because I am some hippie, although I am a product of that 1960s union. It's because we know that the mental happiness of our students and students across the country is not particularly good. And what would make our lives far easier teaching them is if a much higher proportion of them were over the moon they were here and really enjoying themselves, and not worrying that they weren't good enough and how on earth are they going to cope at these exams, which they've got no way of predicting and being able to do in the way that they did so well at the exams that meant they could come in here. Thank you very much for your attention.